The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to start another one of our Urban Night magazine conversations. In this month's issue, there is a piece about Jean Baker, who has written this incredible book called Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. Of course, Jean Baker is a professor of history at Goucher College. She's been there a while. She's author of Sisters, The Lives of American Suffragettes, and one of our leading historians, and joins us in the studio. And Jean Baker, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark.
So this is now obviously not the first person who's written a biography of Margaret Sanger. But before I go there, let me go here. Because maybe one of the reasons you wrote this book is because there are many people who don't even know who that is anymore. And she was this great famous person for a long time. And in the midst of this battle over women's rights and women's rights over their own bodies and rights what they can do with their own reproductive lives, her work is more important than ever, perhaps, but people don't know who she is.
I think you're right about invisibility. I'm always surprised. I like to try out biographical subjects on my students, and so I have a show of hands. Who's heard of Adlai Stevenson? Zero. Who's heard of James Buchanan? A few. In the case of Margaret Sanger, I think she has disappeared from young people's vision. She should be there, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was it was increasingly evident that she was being demonized and vilified by the folks that we're hearing a great deal from right now in the presidential campaign.
So, in a nutshell, before we go a little deeper into her life, who, for our listeners, just what she was, what she meant in terms of women's right to choose and this birth control and what she stood for back when, in the early 1900s through the late 1900s, really.
Sanger is born Margaret Higgins in 1879. She's nobody. And that, I think, is one of the appealing things about her story. She is the brand name of birth control. She names it. It's Margaret Sanger who names what is called contraception or all of these euphemisms, voluntary parenthood, et cetera, et cetera. She calls it birth control because that's exactly what she meant by it. She goes to jail for it. She starts the first American clinic. And throughout her life, she's indefatigably working to change public opinion. And the last chapter of her story is, of course, that she's the enabler for the pill. She dies.
The birth control pill.
The birth control. Yes. Right. Everything is going to be birth control. Contraception. She's just puts a lens on and she's just singularly focused on birth control. And she's angry sometimes when other women take on different causes. She sees birth control as absolutely necessary. She sees it, as all good reformers do, as the answer to the world's problems.
Right.
Whether it's too many people or whether it's women who have babies that are too closely spaced or too many babies, Margaret Sanger believes that birth control is the answer.
Now, and Margaret Sanger, I joked as you sat down in the studio that I was going to, like, the subtext was going to be Margaret Sanger was hot.
Mark, only you. Only you could have brought that up as the first thing. Margaret Sanger once said, if you're strongly sexed, you're richly endowed. And so she lived that with these multiple boyfriends that she had. Her love affairs began when she was in boarding school, and they continued throughout her life. She died when she was in her 80s, but she certainly had the love and admiration of many, many men. She was the kind of woman that would have a love affair and then stop having sex with whomever it was, but whoever it was would continue to love Margaret Sanger, and I think that's an extraordinary thing to be able to do. Usually women like Sanger leave a trail of angry lovers of the past, but not Margaret Sanger.
So what? And it's interesting, and I said it only half jokingly when I said Margaret Sanger was hot, because the subtitle of your book is not Margaret Sanger's Hot, but A Life of Passion.
Thanks for that. Maybe that would help sales, although yeah, the Catholic bishops are doing their part to help sales.
They're not pushing the book? But A Life of Passion, in some ways, not just in the sexual sense, but that Margaret Sanger's life was about passion, and it felt like in many ways in this book – that was your kind of struggle to find the center for the book.
Yes, you got it. You got it. Maybe we should stop now. Watch lunch.
Sure, let's go.
Yeah, you know, you sit in the bathtub or Archimedean style. He got his great idea, you remember, and he jumped out of the bathtub and he didn't have any clothes on and he ran down the street. I was looking for some central theme besides the really obvious one, you know, hard work, et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking about passion, and I looked in the OED, the Official English Dictionary, and there are these multiple uses of the word passion. And one of them is sacrifice, passion of Christ. And Sanger, it seems to me, sacrificed a good deal of her life for birth control. It's not easy to do this when people humiliate you, they throw things at you. You get angry letters such as, if your mother had only used birth control. But the second meaning, of course, is this sense of eroticism and her passion for sex. And she is, I believe, the first woman who made this, and man in the United States, who made this clear separation between sex and reproduction. Women didn't have to lie on their backs like Queen Victoria and have no fun from sex. Margaret Sanger was the harbinger of this new notion that women are passionate and so are men. And of course, the third reason for the use of the word passion is her passion for her cause, and that's organized birth control and shifting opinion in a very, very Puritan United States.
And I, as I said, we'll get to this a bit later, but I think that is really apropos for the moment we're in, given the attack on women's reproductive rights in America going on today from some sections of our society. That here's a woman. There was a great quote before we go back into history. About Margaret Sanger, and I said, where did I put it? It's right here, where she's the one who actually – oh, yeah. She wrote in 1914, when she could have gone to jail for this, and did, in her Women's Rebel magazine, a woman's body belongs to herself alone, does not belong to the United States of America or any other government on the face of the earth. Enforced motherhood is the most complete denial of a woman's right to life and liberty.
Yes, isn't that
1914.
Wonderful? Yeah, yeah. But it's depressing as well because now we have a small minority of Americans who are pushing for personhood, for a fertilized egg. Can you imagine what that would do to a woman's body? Woman would no longer right. control her own body. So I must say that as I look at what's happening in women's reproductive rights, I have to remember Margaret Sanger. She is so optimistic and persevering. And she also said that this has to be protected always. And I think that's one thing that we have forgotten. Who would have believed that six Republican candidates for the presidency of the United States would support the notion of personhood for fertilized eggs? Who would believe it? Well, Sanger gives us at least some sense that you never should be confident about these kinds of reforms. You can always go backward. And that's, I think, what this minority of Americans is trying to do right now.
Now, well, let's take Margaret Sanger. You said she was born in 1879 in a large Catholic family. Her mother dies because of
tuberculosis, and she's the sixth of 11 children. And it's really an extraordinary background. In some senses, this is a story of ascension, of the means of ascension, that you could be a poor, somewhat undereducated woman growing up in Corning, New York. If you've been to Corning, New York, all your listeners will know that at the top of the hill, there are grand homes. At the bottom of the hill, not so much now, but in 1879, when Sanger was born as Margaret Higgins, the poor Irish family lived at the bottom of the hill. It wasn't class in terms of living on the other side of the tracks. It was living at the bottom of the hill. So Sanger's born into this large family, and her mother has tuberculosis and dies at 48. Sanger once said that her mother lived to be 48. Her father lived to be 80. And she didn't have to say anything more than that to make her point about the influence of childbearing on women's health.
And that's kind of part of what set her on her sojourn. She wanted to be a doctor but ended up being a nurse.
Yes, yes. This is the story of many, many ambitious young. I mean, clearly this is a woman who's a young girl, a young rebel, who's smart and competent and who wants to do things. The only medical school she'd ever heard of was Cornell. She couldn't possibly have afforded to go there. Cornell had only recently started taking women and only a handful. So what she ends up doing is becoming a nurse. She made a decision, and I think that this is something to remember about Sanger, all these contingent choices that we make in our early life. She made some really smart ones. When she was old enough to support herself, and all the Higginses had to work, her sisters were domestic servants working in the homes in the top of the hill. What could you do? You could be a domestic servant. You might work in the Corning Glass Works, or you could get married. And a few women might teach school, but Sanger never had the patience to teach school. So she made this choice that she would become a nurse. It was a new occupation for women. We know now that it's greatly sexually segregated and therefore underpaid because it is sexually segregated. But Sanger went off and learned how to be an OBGYN nurse at this facility in White Plains. And it became one of the crossroads of her career because soon enough she was on the Lower East Side taking care of women who had botched abortions.
And that leads us to the kind of a key piece for her in 1912 when she's on the East Side. And the story about Sadie Sachs.
Yes, yes.
And how this transformed her and the began this movement in many ways.
How wonderful that you know the book. Sometimes. In the summer of 1912, 100 years ago, this summer, Sanger was living in New York. She was the mother of three children. She was married to Bill Sanger at that point, and she got an urgent call from a physician to come to the Lower East Side. A woman was dying of a botched abortion, and remember, abortion was totally illegal in the United States until 1973 and Roe v. Wade. So what women did when they got pregnant, and remember, they had no birth control, was that they had these back alley abortions. So when the hemorrhaging in the case of Sadie Sachs is stopped, she says, I'm 25 years old. I have five children. What can I do not to have another child? And the doctor, indifferent as physicians were during this period, said, tell Jake to sleep on the roof. Now, 7 months later, Sanger's called back to this same Sadie Sachs. She's gotten pregnant again. She's had another abortion, and this time she dies of septicemia. And this became, for Sanger, this founding moment, this epiphany on the road to Damascus for her. And she began this crusade with very, very few of the advantages and tools that we would expect of someone who would be a successful reformer. But she made this commitment in 1912. And Sanger's very dramatic about these things. She writes in her autobiography about walking through the night and seeing dead babies and making this commitment to the women and children of the United States.
So she begins this, and this was something that not just was unpopular, but she was facing, which you can describe, the Comstock Law. Mm-hmm. In America. Mm-hmm. This is more than just saying that, you know, when she began this movement to kind of allow women to get birth control, to teach women their rights, when she published this book, What Every Girl Should Know, that, you know, that this was a dangerous thing she did. Sedition.
Sure. I'm not sure everybody in America remembers these days. They should, especially today when some of these rights are under pressure and are being criticized. And people who support them even are being criticized. I'm thinking of the Rush Limbaugh's recent comments. The Comstock Law it's a federal law passed in 1873, and it made distribution of contraceptive materials illegal. It classified them as pornographic matter. Obscenity. So they were part of this statute, and it was therefore illegal to distribute, to inform other people, to pass on what this generation called pessaries. We would call them diaphragms. And in the context of the times, what Sanger is doing is challenging a very deep-seated conventional behavior that makes contraception obscene matter. And you could go to jail. And she did go to jail. And she did so because she had started a clinic in 4 years after she made this commitment to birth control. She opens the first birth control clinic in the United States. And the women of the Lower East Side flocked to this birth control clinic. It was on 46 Amboy Street in Brownsville, Brooklyn. We have photographs, early photographs of these old-fashioned contraptions that women put their babies in then, all lined up outside of Margaret Sanger's birth control clinic. The 10th day, a very well-dressed woman comes. Sanger is suspicious. Very suspicious, because most of her clients, patients, don't
poor women.
Like this. Yeah. So the woman comes in and is fitted for a pessary and goes out. And, of course, the next day the cops come, arrest Sanger, and soon enough she is sent off to jail. But I want to emphasize that one of the things to remember about Sanger is this wonderful sense of the uses of publicity. Before she went to jail, she had a picture taken of herself with her two boys. She had lost her daughter by this time. And the boys looked just these lovely children, this dainty woman. And the newspapers pick up this picture, and it's really seen throughout the world, the United States. And in time, there's a backlash to the idea of taking a woman and putting her in jail for a month for helping women. But what Sanger does, and this is part of her commitment to the cause, the whole time she's in jail, she's teaching those women about birth control. And when she gets out, She does two things. She goes to a group of wealthy New Yorkers with deep pockets and begins this process of fundraising. And then she goes on a lecture tour throughout the United States. It's an adroit understanding of the uses of publicity.
Yeah, that's. I mean, she was ahead of her time in many ways in this way. I mean, I mean, because there was so much about her. She was we'll get some of the sticky things here in a little bit, especially we won't talk about the moment, but our listeners know the whole question of eugenics, which she was involved in, and we'll get into that, because I think it's really a complex subject when it comes to her and how you kind of portrayed it in your book. But she was in the Socialist Party. Mm-hmm. You write about that. I mean, that one piece that she wrote that was banned was in the Socialist newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. And she had her issues with the Socialist Party as well.
Yes, yes. And I think from her perspective, logically so. Her husband was a socialist. She was a rebel. Her husband, by the way, ran for alderman of a New York borough. I think he got about 7% of the vote. But Americans should remember that socialism was an attractive, appealing alternative to the evils of capitalism, which were so obvious.
Unlike now. Sorry.
Yeah, but try to find a socialist party. Where is it? Where are we? And so Sanger began her life as a rebel with the socialists. She used to stand on corners and hand out socialist literature. And she got accustomed to being harassed. I mean, you have to be have a thick skin to be able to do this stuff. And she began to write for the New York Call, which is the famous socialist newspaper. And she began to write about sex. And in her early material for the Call, she immediately found the power of the state because lots of her material was confiscated. The New York Call columns had to be removed, etc., etc. And so Sanger, who is a good hater, and again, that's another thing you have to be if you're going to be a successful reformer. When Sanger saw what was happening to her, it only made her more convinced that she was doing the right thing. But she was also a friend of anarchists. Anarchists and socialists were very powerful and popular, especially where she lived. She's living in New York. She's playing around with all of the group in the famous group in Greenwich Village, the real nurturer, some of our best writers and critics and whatever. And Sanger goes her way and points out to all of them that they should pay more attention to women's rights.
And it wasn't – this is interesting. This is where kind of a split happened in some ways. I mean, she was not just talking about suffragettes. She wasn't talking just about the right to vote. For her, the issue was the right for women – to control their own sexuality and their own reproductive lives. Mm-hmm. And that was revolutionary and still is in many ways revolutionary, but it was really revolutionary then. She fought – I mean, if you take the arc for us, I mean, she from 1912 until she helped found Planned Parenthood in the 40s, and what will that precursor to that?
Well, the American birth control earlier.
Right, earlier. And even – she takes us right to the foundation of the birth control pill. I mean, so her mm-hmm. life was this arc.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, but an arc goes up and down. I see this as a
trajectory.
Yes. But I do want to say something about the relationship of socialism. Margaret Sanger is really not well educated in the ways that some women and men are educated at the turn of the century. But boy,
she was a poor working class woman.
Yes,
she was a poor working class woman.
Yeah.
That's where she began.
But she's so smart, and she sees immediately that the socialists are as anti-female during this period as are the capitalists, the Democrats, and the Republicans. And so she feels that she's going to have to set up her own movement. How do you do that? And that, it seems to me, is one of the major monuments to this woman, that she was almost single-handedly at the beginning, that she was able to create what we call a social movement. She didn't tag along with the socialists because they paid very little attention to women, and they actually believed that you needed to increase the proletariat in order to have these terrible conditions so you could have a revolution. This did not work for women at all.
Right. So, and it did not. I mean, and so she, just to get a sense of what happened. I mean, I was thinking about the piece where going back to Brownsville and how this kind of trajectory, we'll call it, rather than an arc, when the pamphlet she put out, which I love this thing, which is when she writes to mothers, and the pamphlet was in English, Yiddish, and Italian, right? And she puts this thing out. I'll just read this piece. Can you afford to have a large family? Do you want any more children? If not, why do you have them? Do not kill, do not take a life, but prevent. And she began to demand these services for women.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a first. And it's so revolutionary in some way. There weren't clinics. There weren't places where you went. We are at this cusp in American history where more and more Americans are going to hospitals. There are more and more. That's why she's a nurse, because there are hospitals. If you have a hospital, you need a nurse to take care of the people in the hospital. So Sanger, in many ways, seizes this moment and begins writing these pamphlets that are truly obscene matter for the Comstock folks. I want to talk just about one, and that's
Please.
Family limitation. She didn't usually obfuscate, but if she had put birth control on that, it would have been gone in a minute. But in this early 1915, this is before she starts the clinic, she's written the most comprehensive description of the kinds of birth control that exist for human beings. And, of course, she's on the list of every one of the Comstock agents. You know, can you imagine today if one individual had the idea for some sort of legislation and they went to Congress and they got it through, and then Congress said, you can be an agent and you can serve to police this. And that's what was happening in New York in the period that Sanger's writing and talking and raising money. On the one hand, she's involved with socialists and anarchists to some extent still. And on the other, she's appealing to those really wealthy New Yorkers to help her. She needs money.
And, I mean, she went to jail, as you said. I mean, the police raided her clinic.
Yeah.
Took all of her equipment, put her in jail.
Yeah. And often, when she went on this tour in after she's released from jail, I mean, I guess I would think that you would go home and relax and have a shower maybe, but almost immediately, she's on the road, and she soon is aware that the Catholic Church, who becomes her primal enemy, is in fact violating her rights to speak in lectures. She would go to a place, I'm thinking, for example, of St. Louis, and the Catholic hierarchy would call the owners of the theaters and halls, and they would say, don't let this woman speak. If this woman speaks in our city, you're not going to get the votes of Catholics in the next election. So what would the mayor do? Well, he would close down whatever the theater or meeting place was.
And there's a place you describe in the book where when she was arrested at one place or pulled out from one place by the police, it was actually the Catholic Church in the back of the room pointing out what they should
do.
Yes,
yes.
Right?
Exactly, exactly. This in New York. This is a famous...
This is New York, right? In New York,
yeah,
right, right.
This is a famous incident. And the Hayes, who was the Archbishop, I don't know, was... Yeah, I guess he doesn't get to be card. He's really manipulating what is going on, and her meeting is closed down. But again, there's a backlash because this seems a violation of First Amendment rights. And this was often the defense that her attorneys gave. Her attorneys who defended her in these court actions would argue First Amendment rights. She never wanted that to be the defense. What she wanted was to make this argument that this is a basic human right for women, and it goes beyond even the First Amendment rights.
So we're going to have a very, very brief break and come right back with Jean Baker, who's a history professor at Gallatin College, talking about her latest work, Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. And when we return, we're going to talk a bit about what happened in 1942 and the beginning of the modern birth control movement and how that led to Planned Parenthood. But one of the big stories here we're going to address is the question of eugenics. Some people think Margaret Sanger was a racist. Margaret Sanger wanted to see black folks be denied life and have abortion as a way, birth control as a way to kind of kill the black community. She was also involved with the Negro Project that included Du Bois, Mary McCloy Bethune, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., which we'll explore, as well as what Martin Luther King said about her when he was given the Margaret Sanger Award. With all that and more when we come back, stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Our guest this hour is, I was going to say Margaret Sanger. No, our guest is Jean Baker. Jean Baker, who wrote the book, Margaret Sanger, The Life of Passion. Of course, Jean Baker is professor of history at Gallatin College and one of our leading historians. Her book previous to this was Sisters, The Lives of American Suffragettes in 2005. She's written many books in the course of her time, some of which we've had her on the air for here on The Mark Steiner Show. I'll just give you a sense of what she's done, if I don't mind. James Buchanan, 15th President, Mary Todd Lincoln, a biography, and Affairs of the Party, the Political Culture of Northern Democrats in the mid-19th century. Woman knows her stuff and wrote a really lovely book here on Margaret Sanger. And so, Jean, where we left off, one of the things I think, just very quickly to get to, and then I want to get into this question of eugenics, race, racism, and also the huge push among people in America to paint her as a real racist who wanted to annihilate the black world. I think it's very important to get to. But one of the things we touched on just for a minute before we went to break, and I just want to just very quickly talk about it, is that when all this stuff was happening to her, she never was deterred.
Never.
And she created the Birth Control Review, these organizations, American Birth Control League, the Birth Control Clinical Research Bureau, that became what is now Planned Parenthood.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
She's the founder of all this
stuff. She's the founder, and that's why she is being vilified by those who really don't contextualize her life at all, because she is the founder of Planned Parenthood. History is often messy, and it should be remembered that she was furious when her birth control league, and she's in her 60s at this point, becomes the Planned Parenthood. What is Planned Parenthood, she said.
She hated that name.
And she always wanted this name, birth control, to be the sign of what her reform was. And I think she was unhappy to some extent in her later days because others took over running the institutional. She was not, after she set things up, she was not a good day-to-day.
She's not an administrator.
No. Is that what we call them?
Is that what we call them, something like
bureaucrat?
That? Bureaucrat.
No,
she was not a bureaucrat.
Well.
She was an agitator and a fighter for human rights, for people's rights, for women's rights.
Yes. And you can't, and she was a woman who was able to change opinion. And that's different, it seems to me, from licking stamps or organizing meetings and running them.
So what some of the things about Margaret Sanger that really – this is the piece I think that is used against her and also is a divide in America, maybe one of the reasons that she's been pushed aside in history, is this question of eugenics.
Yes.
And she did – I mean, even you write in your book when you write about how she was influenced by this guy who is really, to me, a very unsavory character in human history, Havelock Ellis, and how he was for eugenics, and you write how he wrote feeble-mindedness is largely handed down by hereditary, though Ellis opposed involuntary sterilization programs, you write as well. But then you write, harsher than he, Sanger believed charity hospitals, pensions, and even sewer systems projected the propagation of what might be race degenerates.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Some background. She's living in a world in which eugenics is a very popular mode of both behavior and thinking. And it comes out of the progressive period. We can understand this, can't we? You meaning good and genes. It was an effort on the part of scientists to create what they thought would be a better world by getting better genes. So the entire United States is awash in this idea. Sanger's not alone. She picks up on eugenicism because she wants to have these scientists, who are very, very prominent, give her some legitimization. And so what happens in the 1920s and 1930s is that Margaret Sanger becomes certainly a fellow traveler. I would argue that her approach to eugenics is quite different from some of these male zoologists, biologists.
Some of whom later on went, even those who were on her board and supported, became Nazis or supported the Nazis.
Yes. I mean,
and black sterilization.
Yes. Hitler, for example, looks to the California laws when he is writing his own laws on sterilization. But again, it's important to remember, and I give you a famous court case, Buck v. Bell in 1927. The Supreme Court ruled Carrie Buck had been involuntarily sterilized. The Supreme Court of the United States, which includes Oliver Wendell Holmes,
Louis Brandeis, right,
and some of the great civil libertarians of our time. Holmes says in the decision, three generations of imbeciles is enough. So Sanger, living in this context, certainly becomes a fellow traveling eugenicist. She does not ever focus on groups. Her most stringent and, I guess, sternest applications of eugenicism come in her commitment to the idea that it might be possible for those who are insane to be involuntarily sterilized. She does not apply this to blacks. And that's a point that is totally lost when we have Herman Cain saying that Margaret Sanger's approach to the black community is one of planned genocide. Remember, the black community is split on even the issue of birth control, and to some extent remains so. You remember as a Baltimorean the flap over Nor plant.
Yeah, there are, it was my very first show 19 really? Years ago. That was my very first show on March 3rd, 1993, was the debate on Nor plant.
Yeah, so well, things go around and come around. So what Sanger wants to do is to provide a feminist form of birth control, and that's of eugenics, and that's birth control. If women use birth control, they can space their babies, they can have fewer babies and spend more time with them, and this will make for a better world. So she is supported by W.E.B. Du Bois. There could be no stronger or more authentic voice of the New York black community than he. And he and some of his friends go to Sanger and say, start a birth control clinic in Harlem, which she does in 1931. And her approach to birth control, if she had not done that, that would have been racist. But beyond starting the birth control clinic in Harlem, which she does not see as genocide, she does not see this in the same terms that somebody like Marcus Garvey of the United Negro Improvement Association sees it. And I would argue that even today there is this divide in the black community over the issue of birth control. And the issue is obvious. One can understand why some blacks and African Americans would not support a birth control on the basis that they need a cohesive, large community to have a voice in white America. But Sanger's been hijacked. And she's been hijacked by a group of people who want to close down Planned Parenthood. I thought originally to prevent abortion, which is a legal right for all American women now. But now I see that these people are going beyond this, and they want to stop contraception. So Sanger, who's commitment to birth control is simply being distorted, I believe, by the right wing.
One of the things, I mean, she did, not to beat a dead horse here, but I mean, she did on her boards and in her work, and even that one incident that she wrote about where she addressed the women of the KKK in northern New Jersey. She allowed herself to be surrounded by some very unsavory characters who did believe in civilization, who did want to have eugenics against the African-American community and other communities who lived in poverty in America. I mean, she did that.
I totally agree with you. Yes, she did do that.
As you say, yeah.
Yes, but I would take, I think, some exception to the idea about talking to women of the KKK. Do you not talk to women of the KKK?
I don't know. Good question.
If your agenda is that we would all be better off with birth control, and I think we'd get fairly universal agreement with that, as long as we leave aside these folks who are pressing for fertilized egg personhood. If we leave aside that, then you want the world to have this message. And that's the kind of reformer that she was.
Now, there was this. I'm
sorry,
go ahead.
Guilt by association. If you talk to the KKK, she's not for the KKK. This doesn't mean that she supports any of their ideas. Margaret Sanger is against segregation.
From the very beginning.
Before many Americans had even considered trying to end segregation. There's a lovely story about Sanger's household housekeeper who's coming back from Tucson. Sanger moves to Tucson in later years and is unable to be served at a Greyhound bus station. And what does Sanger do? She immediately fires off the angriest letter you have ever read. Now, this is a woman who today we're hearing she's a racist, she hates blacks, she's trying to, destroy the black race. I don't think it washes.
The one thing she did have, we talked about, but you mentioned, was the Negro Project.
Yes.
And again, this is another arc that she had. I mean, this is a project you write about and people write about, that included Mayor McLeod Bethune and Adam Clayton Powell Jr. And the facilities were actually run by African American physicians and nurses in the community, and it goes to the time when Martin Luther King gets the Sanger Award that his wife, Coretta King, takes in his name because King couldn't be there that day, and the speech through him that she gave about why Sanger is as he. A warrior for human rights.
Yes, that this was similar to her husband's, campaign. I think it's sort of sad, though, that in later years, what we've seen is when, say, Hillary Clinton won the Margaret Sanger Award, there was this just, oh, isn't this awful? Why would she take some sort of award from such a group? And it suggests to me just how far we've swung rightward, that Hillary Clinton would be assailed for taking an award that I think most people would be proud of.
So so we have Margaret Sanger, who, and I want to talk about the near the end of her life, when the birth control pill was coming into reality.
Mm-hmm.
And this was her, almost a dream for her come true in terms of where the world should be.
She had actually talked about a pill. And she had done everything to find something, because we have to remember that she's promoting a cause for which there's no solution. The birth control for women, and to some extent for men, although rubbers get to be better than they used to be after... after a while, but she's promoting a cause in which the solutions, and these are spermicides and diaphragms, are not really very effective. So she wanted a pill, and she talked about it. And if she heard that someone had some new thing, she went off, for example, to the Soviet Union in 1934 because she heard somebody could immunize women. Think of that. Using male sperm, and you would be immunized, and therefore you would not get pregnant. In any case, Sanger listens to the scientists, and by the 1930s, she knows that the endocrinologists are the ones that have the answer. They understand hormones, and they are beginning to understand this complex process of the corpus luteum and the pituitary gland, and essentially, that progesterone will stop the production of eggs. There are a lot of other researchers working, but Sanger's smart enough to realize that this is the one, and she recruits her very, 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 very rich friend, Catherine Dexter McCormick, and they one day, in 1953, they ride up to Dr. Gregory Pincus's lab. Pincus knows more about mammalian eggs than probably anybody in the universe. He has not been working on this, but the women promise him money if he will begin work on what becomes in 1960 Inavid, which is the first pill. One final note on that. When Inavid was first marketed, it was marketed for infertile women. But it didn't take long for the rest of the country to realize what was up.
So this is, I mean, this is, going beyond that, how she pushed this, wanted to push this pill and the birth control pill and make it available for all women. I mean, this was... This, I mean, but hey, we're talking about a woman who, 1912, started the first clinic because a woman died of a botched abortion, and now she's in the midst of a world 50 years later where she could see that women could have...
Yeah, right. Yes, yes. So I think it's an extraordinary... I think she's an extraordinary woman, not without flaws, but certainly a woman who has changed all of our lives.
So are you, I know you're happy you wrote this book.
Well,
aren't you?
One must be.
No, I mean, this is something because I mean, you. This was to you. It seems to me this was one of those things that you had to do. I mean, you could write a book about James Buchanan because you're interested in American history and what that part of our history meant to us. But this is something different.
Yes. Thank you so much for that. It's right. I agree. Yes. Thank you for saying that.
So this is, and I think that she's, so the book is Margaret Sanger is Hot. No, I'm just kidding. The book is Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion by Dr. Jean Baker, professor of history at Goucher College. And it's a very important book, I think a very important part of our history now to think about what it means in the context of this world we're in today. Where women are still fighting for their rights as equal citizens, fighting for their rights, their reproductive rights, their rights to control their own bodies and their own health and their own health care in America. So Margaret Sanger by Jean Baker. Margaret, I mean, Jean, good to have you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.